broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City, 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson, president of the Eastern Shore Writers Association.
Writers have known for years that putting our stories and our feelings on paper can help us find emotional and mental clarity. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writers Edition. Ron Capps is with us in our studio today. Out of his own experience, Ron has taken this insight to a new level. He created and directs a program that teaches veterans the craft of writing to help them better manage and control the memories of their traumatic experiences. Ron, welcome to Delmarva Today, the Writer's Edition.
Thanks, I'm pleased to be here.
Ron Capps is the director of the Veterans Writing Project in Washington, D.C., and teaches at a number of locations and venues around the city. Ron, where do you teach in Washington?
We work with George Washington University right downtown on their campus. We also work with the Writers Center, which is in Bethesda. And we teach at a couple of locations for them, including on Capitol Hill and up in Bethesda. But we also teach at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center at a part of the hospital there called the National Intrepid Center of Excellence, where we work with severely wounded service members just returned from the war.
Wonderful, Ron. Thank you. Ron served 25 years in the Army, in the Army Reserve, and is a combat veteran of Afghanistan. He is a contributor to Time Magazine's Battle and blog and to Foreign Policy. His literary writing has been featured in JMWW, The New York Times, The Little Patuxent Review, Prime Number, and River Lit. His essay, Writing My Way Home, will be published in the Delmarva Review in October. Ron, the Washington Post called your essay, Back from the Brink, War, Suicide, and PTSD, stunningly good, and I certainly concur. What other awards have you received for your writing?
An essay I wrote that's called The French Lieutenant's iPod won first prize for creative nonfiction in Press 53's 2011 Open Awards. And another essay that I wrote for JMWW is called Yellow. And it was selected as a notable in Best American Essays of 2012. Both of those will appear as chapters in my memoir that comes out next year.
Well, congratulations, Ron, on your published work, and thank you very much for being with us today. What is the Veterans Writing Project, and how did you come to create it?
The Writing Project is both a teaching organization and a publishing organization. We are a group of veterans, combat veterans, who are working writers and have gone back to school to get graduate writing degrees. And our goal is to transfer that knowledge that we've gained to others so that they can tell their own stories. We run no-cost writing seminars and workshops for veterans, for service members, and for their families, because we think it's really important to keep the families inside that circle. We teach fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. We're branching out this year into playwriting and screenwriting. We are also a publishing organization. We have a quarterly literary review that we call O Dark 30, in which we publish writing by veterans, by their families, by service members. And we are publishing our first books this year under our imprint called BCG Books.
That's wonderful. It sounds like you're incredibly busy these days. There are a number of veterans writing programs. Are you associated with any of these other veterans writing programs, like, for instance, the Warriors Writers in Philadelphia?
We're We're not linked formally. We're these groups, we're all sort of in touch with each other. We all know one another and know one another's works. There's the Warrior Writers in Philadelphia. There are two groups in New York City, one at NYU, one at Fordham. There's a group at Syracuse University. There's groups in California and Texas. We're all aware of what the other group is doing, and we try to mutually support each other. But no, we're not linked formally.
Right. I understand that a woman's service group back after the Second World War began working with veterans of the Second World War on writing projects. Are you familiar? And I understand they're still active out in Mission, Kansas. Are you in any way associated with them or have any history with them?
We don't really. I've admired their work, and one of the things that I found very interesting is that they started simply publishing a sort of distribution by hand mimeograph sheet that they would run off on the old mimeograph machines in the hospital at Mission, and they have survived since the end of the Second War. So I can only hope that we have that sort of longevity.
You're on a great tradition with them, I believe. You tell us in your book, Writing War, that you were treated for post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD in Afghanistan. How were you affected by PTSD?
Well, one thing about PTSD is that it affects everyone, every survivor differently. Mine spurred from having served in five different wars over a period of 10 years. I went from Rwanda to Afghanistan to Iraq to Darfur. I left out Kosovo. I'm sorry. I went from Rwanda to Kosovo to Afghanistan, then Iraq to Darfur. And over those 10 years, I was exposed to and party to just an enormous amount of violence, the genocide in Darfur, the genocide in Rwanda. And I came away really badly traumatized. What I found out is that I needed a way to get control of those traumatic memories, and traditional therapy didn't work well for me. Traditional therapy and medication didn't work well for me. I was self-medicating too much with whiskey and whatever meds I had, and that didn't work very well. So after a number of years, I was so badly into the grip of post-traumatic stress disorder that I was actually stopped in a suicide attempt and medevaced home from Darfur in what became sort of my last overseas assignment. So that's how it affected me. My depression and the lack of clarity of thought, the inability to control the memories, to control the things that I saw, grew so powerful that I was ready to end my life. What is bringing me back from that is what I wrote about in the essay Back from the Brink, is writing. And writing has been the tool that I've used to get control of those memories.
Well, we're going to talk in a few minutes about how writing has helped you and what it has meant to you in your work. But when you went into the Virginia Medical Center for your first appointment, you have a section in the essay that's going to be published in the Delmarva Review about that first appointment. I wondered if you would please read that section of your essay for us.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Just as background, this is my first visit to the VA hospital in D.C., and I'm coming in to start my treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. Inside the door, there was an information desk with a guy in a wheelchair behind it wearing a DAV piss cutter cap. He looked me up and down and made some sort of judgment about me. I couldn't imagine what it might have been. I stammered a bit, explaining that I'd come for my first appointment. My hands were shaking, so I held them down below the edge of the counter. He quietly told me where the registration office was and pointed that way. Walking through the lobby, I imagined everyone there looking at me, thinking, Look at the psycho boy, home from the war and broken. What a pussy. I felt like it was my first day in high school, and I was dressed in a bright pink tutu. I took a number and waited. The waiting room was actually part of the main lobby, so it was noisy and there were lots of people walking past. I kept my head down until my number was called. Inside the office, a woman looked over my paperwork. I had brought some of my DD-214s, the document that details a veteran's military service, showing training, awards and decorations, combat time served, etc. Then she started entering my data into the system. She was perfectly pleasant and did a good job of ignoring my symptoms until she obliquely asked if I wanted to go to the emergency room instead of the clinic. Maybe I should have. At my psychological screening upstairs in the mental health wing, away from the general medical patients, I was interviewed by someone new to the system, maybe a recent PhD graduate with a more qualified, I assumed, supervisor attending. I had to fully detail all my problems. I started at the beginning in Rwanda, then to Kosovo, then Afghanistan and my treatment there for PTSD, then Iraq, then Darfur and my failed suicide attempt, on and on through the drive to the hospital that morning. Staring at the floor, wringing my hands, I quietly described my memory loss, my unbridled fear and anxiety, my inability to control the images of the dead appearing in my head at all hours of the day and night, my weird hypervigilance issues. I even included the wholly irrational things like my fear of driving. At that point, the supervisor snickered. There was an ugly silence in the small room for a few seconds, and only the sound of the air conditioning blowing through the grate in the wall and someone's heels clicking down the hallway outside. I looked up. The interviewer looked stricken, and her supervisor quickly looked down at her notes. Shame welled in my throat and my eyes. My humiliation was absolute. Even the doctors were laughing at me.
Even the doctors were laughing at you. What would you say to those doctors today, Ron?
Well, I hope they've become a little more professional in their handling of patients. There's an enormous stigma attached to asking for help for mental health issues. And these were psychologists or psychiatrists that one would have hoped had better self-control and a better understanding. Throughout the military, throughout the veterans community, seeking mental health help is often considered breaking, being broken, being weak. You know, if someone has a chemical imbalance that affects their kidneys, they just go to the doctor and nobody thinks anything of it. But if they have a chemical imbalance that affects their mental health, they're considered to be weak and broken. And I think that's one of the great tragedies of that returning service members face and their families, is overcoming that presumption of weakness, that presumption that this is something you can control, rather than simply being another health issue that we have to work through.
So the stigma of post-traumatic stress disorder can become a stress-producing activity within itself. I mean, if even the doctors are laughing at you, that compounds the issue, it would seem, that that you're dealing with. So how has writing helped you then deal with your own post-traumatic stress experience?
Well, one of the treatments for PTSD is called exposure therapy, and it's simply a matter of bringing up these issues, bringing up the problems, the images, the fears, the anxieties, again and again until they become less potent, less powerful. And what I found was that by writing about things that had happened to me and things that I'd taken part in the wars, I was able to distance myself from them a little bit, as if, you know, you were reaching in to grab something in a fire. You can't hold it in your hand, but if you have an asbestos glove on, you can hold it, and that allows you to shape it. There's a filter of sorts, and writing served that purpose for me. It allowed me to get control of these memories rather than them being in control of me. And the space where I do my writing is upstairs in the attic at my house, and I put a little sign up on the wall that says, either you control the memory or the memory controls you. And, you know, a writer might think either you control the story or the story controls you, but any of the creative arts can serve this purpose, whether it's dance, drama, two- or three-dimensional art, music therapy. Any of these things can work, but writing is what worked for me. It allowed me to distance myself from these memories, to get better control over them, to shape them, and to come to understand them a little bit more. And, you know, it's a process. I'm not fully home yet, but I'm getting there, and writing is how I'm able to do that.
That's a fantastic comment. Either you control the story, or the story controls you. And what I hear you saying is that writing gets those images outside of yourself, so that they become something that is malleable, something that you can work with, and there is also this sense of creating a narrative of well that that you say in your book that helps you make sense of some of these images and some of these activities. How do you use writing to help these images make sense to you?
It's actually hard to explain, but I think the simplest way of approaching it is that we're able to, when we write, to use metaphor, to substitute one thing for another so that we come to better understand it. And this is something uniquely human. And so by doing that, by writing about these experiences, I think for anyone, but I can really only speak for myself, it allows me really to put it into a different perspective. Instead of it being something that comes when it's in control, when that memory is in control, when I would wake up in the middle of the night in Afghanistan with images of the dead from Rwanda or from Kosovo come back, and they were in control. But by writing about what happened to me, being able to concretize that, to make it into something physical, into something tangible, rather than something that is just in the back of my head. That, I think, is a great part of the process. There's a researcher out at the University of Texas named James Pennebaker. And Dr. Pennebaker's been working on this for all his career. And anyone that I think is interested in this kind of work, his books are almost all very approachable. Some of them are written in medical speak. But a lot of his research has been done so that he can just give that away to show people ways of how this works. And anyone that's interested in that, I would definitely point them toward Dr. James Pennebaker's work.
Your book, Writing War, in addition to establishing why you write and what it means to write about trauma, emphasizes the craft of writing. What kind of role does the craft of writing play in your writing and in your teaching? In a correspondence that we had earlier, you mentioned that you had done some stream of consciousness writing, and it took a long time, and I love the phrase, to beat the writing into shape. What do you mean by the craft of writing, and how do you use that to, quote, beat the writing into shape?
When I first started writing about what happened in Kosovo, what happened in Rwanda, and the Eastern Congo, it all just came out as, you know, mostly this hugely long stream of consciousness piece that there may have been some punctuation in there, but there was certainly not enough. There were no paragraph breaks. It was just trying to get that information, you know, onto the page, to get it out of me. It's it's not usable in that form. It's not readable. It's just this long sentence of, and then, and then, and then, and then, and then. And what I've had to do over the past few years is to really break that down through the revision process and think about it as a narrative. Look at narrative structure. Look at plot. Look at the development of characters. Look at dialogue. Look at scenes. Look at all of the elements of craft that writers use. And, you know, how does setting play into this? And then shape those long, formless pieces into essays. And that is the revision process that I think every writer both dreads and looks at as the thing that's going to make this work, because when you start with something that's, you know, without form and void, I think is the phrase, then you have to shape it. And just through the revision process and by studying writing and by studying the craft and becoming competent in how to explain what's happening, I feel like I'm able to bring that into the classroom. And when we at the Veterans Writing Project run our seminars and our workshops, you know, all of our instructors are combat veterans. All of our instructors have graduate writing degrees, and all of us are going through the same processes of trying to get our work published. And so we bring that to the table, and we can work with veterans and with their family members to, you know, hopefully transfer those skills to them so that they can tell their own stories.
Right. You see the tools of the craft then as a way of manipulating and working the images. It gives you a set of tools. Am I correct in getting that from what you said? So the craft, for any writer out there, the craft is crucially important because that's what allows you to work your story and make it into something other than a, and then and then and then, or a stream of consciousness. In your book, you say that writing the military experience is different than writing about other human struggles. How does writing about the military experience differ from writing other kinds of literature?
Well, it's different in a way that writing about any specialized work or any culture is different. The military and the military community really are cultures that, you know, I mean, right now we have less than 1% of the American population serving in these two wars that are just coming to an end. And so in order to bring your readers into that community, into that world, into that culture, you've got to establish your authority as a writer. So you have to use appropriate language. You have to use settings that are actually sets for the military experience. But then you also have to be careful not to use jargon, not to use acronyms, not to use things that will drive readers away. So it's different in that you have to be very careful when you're establishing your authority as a writer not to cross this line into jargon, or that by using this specific language, you drive people away. But even within the military community, the Navy has a different language than the Army, the Marines and the Air Force, the Special Operations community, the Green Berets, the Rangers, the SEALs, they have their own specialized language. And if you're not a part of that culture, you have to learn what all those words mean. You have to learn how people talk. You have to learn how people express ideas. How do they behave? There's the officer and the enlisted, the young enlisted, the older enlisted. There are all these different groups within the military culture. And so to express that is the same challenge any writer feels, to express what life would be like in any culture. But because there are so few people these days that are actually a part of it, there's a real challenge, I think, to allow ourselves to both establish authority and yet not go too far that we drive readers away.
Right. You say that in your book that not only is it important to write in order to control the images and the memory, but that it is important to bear witness. What does it mean for you in your writing and in your teaching to bear witness?
Simply put, it's bringing back the story of the war and of the participants in the war to those who stayed behind, and particularly to those who sent us as soldiers off to war. You know, when you think back to the Greeks and Troy, you know, that war preceded Twitter by a few generations, and so you couldn't just tweet about what was happening to you in Afghanistan,
right,
or Facebook, or post things on your Facebook page. So fighters came back from that war, and they were required to tell their stories in the public square so that their families could welcome them home and understand what they'd been through, but also so that people would understand what it meant to send a generation of men off to war. Oliver Wendell Holmes was a Union infantry officer, and after the war, he gave a speech in New York at a Veterans Day event, and he said, "In our youth," and I'm paraphrasing, he says, "We were lucky. In our youth, our hearts were touched with fire, and we have a responsibility to bring back the report to those who come after us," and that's bearing witness. We have a responsibility, the generation that has gone to this war, to tell the truth, both in a way of honoring the lives that were lost and the families that were separated and the carnage that was created, but also as a way of recognizing the sacrifice of others and of explaining to those who stayed behind, this is what we went through, this is what you sent us to do.
You make an interesting point in your book that such a small percentage of the population is involved in these two conflicts that we're involved in. That I would assume that plays a role in your bearing witness as well.
I think it's important. I mean, we've got, you know, 311 million Americans right now, and about 2.4 million American men and women have gone to these two wars, so that's well under 1%. And that's the smallest percentage in American history. We don't have a draft. It's an all-volunteer force. But, you know, the last chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Admiral Mullen, said he was very worried about developing a class of warriors in America that was separate from the other 99%, and this great divide between the civil and military populations. And so by giving veterans and service members and their families the tools they need to tell their stories, we hope that they will take those stories out into the public and help bridge that divide.
Ron, you have a beautiful piece in your book, Writing War, on why we write. I wondered if you would read that passage for us on why we write.
Sure. In a way, we write to make our voices eternal, to give a sense of permanence to our ideas. In doing this, we presume that our ideas deserve permanence. We write because we believe at some level that we have something worth saving, worth saying. We believe we have some commentary on the human condition that is of value and should be remembered. We're very full of ourselves, aren't we? French novelist and paratrooper Georges Perec said, "We write because we have lived, nothing more." I think it might be a little different for each of us. Some of us write because we need to figure things out, and writing is one way of doing that. Putting the words down on paper helps us think through an event or a story and come to a better understanding of it. Sometimes we do this simply because we need to get the story out, to tell it and be done with it. Writing turns the ideas into something concrete, something physical that we can then push away from ourselves. It can give us distance. Sometimes we write to express things that can't be said out loud. We may have some sense of or experience that can't be expressed directly. Writing allows us to create metaphors, one thing that substitutes for or represents another. and gives us a chance to express something unexplainable. So we write. We ponder and ruminate, and then scribble and scratch or hunt and peck our way through a story. We write to tell a story. Some of us tell stories easily. Some of us struggle to get the words onto the page. We anguish over every turn of phrase, over every plot choice. Joseph Heller said, "Every writer I know has trouble writing." Heller flew 60 combat missions as a bombardier on a B-25 in the Italian front during World War II. Compared to that, writing should be easy.
Ron, thank you for all you've done for our country and for the continuing work that you're doing with the nation's veterans. And thank you for sharing your insights with us today. If you would like to learn more about the Veterans Writing Project, you can find them at www.veteranswriting.org. This is Harold Wilson. Thank you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson, president of the Eastern Shore Writers Association. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.